Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. And we're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon or reach us through restaurantguysradio.com. And now you can download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Morning, Francis.
As Christmas approaches in the restaurant business, I look forward to a long nap in the month of January. Oh, my.
I just want to sleep between Christmas and New Year's. Well, I need one solid week of sleep.
The 23rd is not a big restaurant day because most of you are done with your parties by then, and so I must shop for a big Irish Catholic family all the Christmas shopping on the 23rd.
So you're leaving me alone to go work lunch in both restaurants. Thanks very much. See ya.
Everyone's getting binoculars. I get a deal.
Francis's big shopping day for 15 years now has been December 23rd.
I like the
Gotta take off. Gotta go. Bye.
I like the thoughtful gifts. Yeah, one of those. Great. You got that in the large? One of those two.
I'll take the medium. You don't have a large? I'll take the medium. Give it up.
Well, but I think that's one of the things that's very interesting. I was quoted recently in an article in the New York Star Ledger.
That couldn't have been that interesting then.
Well, not my quote, but the article in general. They talked about the nature of changing Christmas parties and. It was something I hadn't really thought of until the reporter called and asked, what's going on with Christmas parties in the Garden State? And two things I think are really the nature of the Christmas party has changed. The two things that are going on is one is some people are going for a more lavish affair, but I think and it's more centered on the food or an event, and it's less about just an open bar.
And getting as drunk as you possibly can, as fast as you possibly can.
I mean, we're 40 years.
And seeing if you can pass out with your cheeks on the coffee machine.
Christmas parties, even when we started in this business about 15 years ago, were, it was like, it wasn't quite the bachelor party level of craziness, but people got really nutty at Christmas parties, and I never quite understood it. I mean, you have to work with these people the next day. I always wondered, was there one guy that got fired after every Christmas party?
Well, sure. I mean, who wants, as the boss of a lot of people, who wants to go around and say, okay, I got to fire you because you were misbehaving at the Christmas party, you were out of line, harassing somebody, or
the good news is the
or you fell asleep under the Christmas tree, whatever.
The good thing though is I think that the nature of Christmas parties has changed, and I think at least in our restaurants, one of the things that's happened is the food has become much more important. Years ago, even in the fine restaurants, people cared less about the food as about having the room and having some music and having as much liquor available as possible. And
well, I think some of that has to do with the drunk driving laws. It really does. There's more fear of getting intoxicated and driving home, that's not necessarily a bad thing.
But there's a less but better aesthetic, and people are really into the food and really letting us have a great time bringing them great food. And I think that's really kind of a cool thing.
Well, I think exactly what you're talking about is people are deciding to have two or three really good drinks or really nice glasses of wine instead of seven Manhattans.
And it's remarkably civilized, and I like that. And I also like that the idea we're selling. I mean, we have a printing press for gift certificates now at the restaurants. Local restaurant gift certificates. While a gift certificate to our restaurant would be the best Christmas gift you could give anyone, there are some other ideas about things that Christmas gifts, where we can go with Christmas gifts. One of them, I think, is a really bad idea. This appeared in the New York Times recently under the title, You'll Never Lose That Chateauneuf du Pape Again. The Art of Wine Collecting, the IntelliScanner Wine Collector adds a decidedly 21st century twist. Okay, what this is, it's a little scanner that keeps track of all your bottles of wine. If you're at a liquor store, you can scan the UPC code on the bottle of wine.
And then all the time what's in your inventory, as long as you scan it on the way out.
Right, and you know where it goes, and you can program into your computer where it is in your extensive wine cellar. Now, this isn't a gift for everyone, I guess, but you need a big wine cellar. But it also doesn't make sense to me,
Well, it doesn't make sense to you for a couple of reasons.
The best wines in the world don't. It's one of the few products that still they don't come with UPC labels.
The certainly the small production, the estate bottled, where Francis and I think that the best wines and certainly some of the best values in wine are coming from, still today, are from estate bottled small production wines, not from the Kendall Jacksons, and I'm not here to bash Kendall Jackson, but
I
not
am.
From the not from the
bash,
Kendall
bash,
Jacksons,
bash.
Not from the Opichis, not from the Gallo
if
gallon
you would like
jugs.
If you would like your wine made by a corporate executive,
that's what happens. If they make 1,000 cases of a wine, nobody's putting a UPC code
right,
on
no one's going to register the UPC.
Nobody's registering that. If you make 1,000,000 cases of wine, you're certainly going to do that.
In fact, I'm going to put out there, and I think it's a very loose rule, but if you're looking for quality wine, look for wines that don't
right. Avoid the scanner.
No, but
avoid,
I mean,
avoid the UPCs.
Most wines in your wine shop are going to have a UPC code.
Mm-hmm.
Ask the clerk, ask the wine shop owner about the ones that don't.
Yeah, because that
means they're from a small producer. That's mm-hmm. that's a pretty good little tip if you're out there shopping for something unusual. Doesn't mean it's going to be great.
Right, and always remember that this is not a hard and fast rule. There are some small producers out there making
terrible wine,
making schlock.
Right, exactly. But
so realize that just because somebody is a garagiste, small wine producer, doesn't mean they're going to be making great wine.
Well, I have a couple of other sites that I found useful. I did a bunch of Christmas shopping online. I have to do the bricks and mortar stuff, but there are a bunch of other websites.
Because that's the only stores that are open at 2 a.m.
Are
the ones that are not bricks and mortar.
But the amount of stuff that's available online is amazing. And one of the sites that I really like is La Tienda. It's www.tienda.com, T-I-E-N-D-A. Mm-hmm. And Tienda.com sells all things Spanish, including the amazing...
What does Tienda mean, Francis?
Means store.
Excellent.
But Tienda.com is an American company based here where they sell amazing high-end Spanish stuff. Mm-hmm. And they have, all the way up to the top, they have Jamón Ibérico, which is... We had them on the show to talk about this, actually.
You're going to get me a ham for Christmas this
year. No, too expensive. Jamón Ibérico has never been available in the United States before and will be. The ones that will be coming over to the United States are curing now. They'll be here in 2 years. It's $1,000 a ham. Now, a ham's big. I mean, you know, you can get a lot of portions out of a ham.
It's not that big. It's still a ham. It's still only one ham.
Well, what do you think that comes to a pound?
I'll bet it's $40 a pound.
Yeah, worth it.
What is it, 50 pounds for 25 pounds for a ham?
No, I bet it's 40 pounds.
Okay.
25 pounds.
So
anyway, but Latienda.com has all sorts of other stuff that's kind of interesting. If you go there today, you can probably get stuff in time for Christmas for Spanish. There's FrenchFeast.com for French stuff. That's just the way it sounds, www.frenchfeast.com. You have, for Italian stuff, there's a great website called gustiamo.com, which is www.gustiamo.com.
You got to spell Gustiamo.
G-U-S-T-I-A-M-O, and we're all going to put this up on our website. And if you want a clearinghouse overall, you can go to ethnicgrocer.com, www.ethnicgrocer.com, and, you know, give the gift of food.
And some really interesting products.
And there's some overnight stuff available, but if you get it there in time for New Year's, I think that people will eat it anytime.
And remember, when you're giving a gift to someone who has everything, give them consumables so you can give them something again next year.
Exactly. Well, we're going to come back in just a moment. We're going to talk with a good friend of ours who's an instructor, a professor at the Culinary Institute of America. He's written a new book called At Your Service, which is a hands-on guide to the professional dining room for an inside look at what happens in the greatest culinary school in the United States and what they're teaching people about dining room service. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys.
Hey, you're back with the Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, and we are here talking to you today about service in restaurants and careers in restaurants. And one of the most interesting guys that we know who's made a very interesting career in restaurants is a guy named John Fisher. John is a professor at the CIA, the Culinary Institute of America, the nation's foremost restaurant school, and he's also written a new book called At Your Service, A Hands-On Guide to the Professional Dining Room. It's published by the CIA, and it's pretty darn interesting, and he's here to talk to us today. Hi, John.
Hello there.
Hey,
are
John Fisher, how are you?
Lombardi Restaurant right now?
We are not. We are at a radio station.
Calls?
You can come for the meatballs later, John. Okay. We got a radio show to do.
Oh, you're on the radio.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So, John, you've written now. John, you were a maitre d' in New York for a long time. You were trained at the CIA. You've worked in kitchens and dining rooms. You've served royalty, and
once with the royalty.
And you screwed it up, I understand.
No, he loved me.
But it says in the book that you didn't serve royalty first.
It's America.
It's America.
We don't have royalty. We serve
and if
you
it had been a Kennedy, I would have served that person first.
Yeah. Well, all right. Now, the new book.
Yeah.
Was this written as an instruction manual for CIA?
Partly in that it was intended to replace the book that's currently being used here at the school. And Wiley, the publisher, wanted a different book that was a little bit more accessible to people who weren't necessarily Culinary Institute faculty and workers. Mm-hmm. And they wanted something a little bit broader based, but still to cover the same material. So they asked me to change a proposal that I'd made to them. They said, if you make a couple of changes, you have a contract. I said, oh, change is good.
Does that mean you'll give me money? Now, so the book is designed to be interesting to the non-restaurant person.
Not necessarily in the planning stages, but mm-hmm. I'd like to think that it's something that non-restaurant folks will be able to read and get some both practical information and perhaps even some enjoyment out of.
Well, I think what in looking at the book, John, that what it's trying to do is a lot of what we're trying to do on this show is maybe give people a behind the scenes look at exactly what we do and why we do it.
Do you think they really want to see that?
Not all of it. It's a selective. Well, you know, I mean, I think that people often wonder, and they ask us all the time, something that you deal with in your book, I'll pick an example. People say, you know, why would a restaurant take reservations or not take reservations?
Right.
And you know, there's a chapter in your book where you deal with the ramifications. If you, from the perspective of the restaurateur who's deciding which policy to pursue,
mm-hmm.
What the costs and benefits are in either one of those choices, and some things that you really need to use as safeguards no matter which choice you make.
Yeah, and it's not just a yay or nay thing. It doesn't mean you're a great restaurant that you take reservations. There are pretty subtle reasons for doing it or not doing it.
Mm-hmm. Why don't we talk about that a little bit? Give people an idea of the kind of stuff that you talk about. Why would a restaurant choose not to take reservations?
Usually when it's a restaurant that is more casual and has a shorter stay time when people mm-hmm. eat quickly and run, mm-hmm. you know, as we say, eat, pay, tip, leave,
mm-hmm.
There's an influx of customers that will always fill the tables, and for the guests, they don't necessarily want to have to make a reservation at a place like that.
Sure.
You know, you're not going to make a reservation for Manny's Taco Shack.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you could, but it's kind of silly, because you're going to go and you're going to hang out at the bar with your friends and have a couple of margaritas and some chips and then maybe wander over to your table. But for a restaurant that is, you know, it's an event, it's an anniversary or something, you don't want to show up there and your table's taken. You know, that for the finer dining, it makes sense to have reservations both for the restaurateur and for the guest.
Especially for an event like that, yeah. I think that sometimes, too, in a restaurant where you don't know how long customers are going to take, there are restaurants, and I think Catherine Lombardi is a restaurant that is a little bit more like this. There are some people who come into Catherine Lombardi and spend 45 minutes. There are some people who spend 3.5 hours.
Yeah.
And so if you're only taking reservations in that scenario, those tables are going to sit empty for a long time, and people who might otherwise be able to come wouldn't be able to come.
Right,
all those
so the
seats
business plan that the guests have no idea of is still important to them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right, right. Well, the idea is you don't want a table sitting there empty for a long time, because then someone who's wanted to dine there can't. And you also don't want someone who you promised that they could have their table at 8 o'clock, but the table that's is sitting there has decided to sit for 3 hours, stay for a long time.
Right, and you don't want to say no to somebody when those people are only going to stay for 45 minutes.
Mm-hmm. But why would a less than casual restaurant, because I've been to these restaurants where you have to wait 2.5 hours on a Saturday night for a table, why would a restaurant choose to do that, and what are the pitfalls of
that?
Well,
I think that's just obscene. You know, mm-hmm. even whether they take reservations or not, and to a certain degree, the first restaurant I ever worked in was the Chart House in Dobbs Ferry, New York, and people would sit and they would wait for 2.5-3 hours drinking pina coladas and strawberry daiquiris on the deck.
You're dating yourself.
And then come and sit down blasted,
mm-hmm.
and say, "Can I have some bread?"
Ah, the 70s.
Is that what that was? But it was, you know, it. I guess it made sense because there was a beautiful place to sit, almost in the Hudson River on a nice deck chair,
right.
and sip cocktails. But that was part of the plan. But when you go to a restaurant for dinner and you're sitting there for 2 hours waiting for your table, whether there's a reservation or not, I just think it's I don't know. I guess if the guest is ready for it, it's fine. But if they've never been there before, I'm walking out.
Yeah, our guest I don't want to surprise like
our
that.
Guest is John Fisher. He's the author of At Your Service, A Hands-On Guide to the Professional Dining Room. He's also a professor at the Culinary Institute of America, and we'll be talking more with him about service in America in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:25.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Catherine Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys radio show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission? To live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The matagat and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC.
Hey, you're back at the Restaurant Guys. Mark Pascal and Francis shot a Stage Left in Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. And we're talking with our friend John Fisher, longtime colleague, peer, lunch mate, and now professor at the Culinary Institute of America and author of a great new book on service. Now, you know, this book and your position as professor at the Culinary Institute places you as one of the top experts in the country on service in dining in America.
Really?
Yeah, it's crazy. As crazy knowing
sad,
you.
Sad, but true.
Are you listening?
You say in your book, you talk about a number of people's views on service. And the book is really a fun read if you're at all interested in restaurants. Or frankly, we have a lot of restaurateurs and restaurant professionals who listen to the show. Mm-hmm. It's invaluable to you guys. Pick up this book. Now,
it's $5 for you, Sean.
I'm getting a kickback. You say in your book, you quote a number of people who say, you know, you can teach service easily, but teaching hospitality is very hard to do. Can you draw the distinction between those two, and can you teach hospitality?
Well, I think...
And you've got 2 minutes.
The difference is that service is carrying stuff around, and hospitality is being nice to people, and you know, in a nutshell. And, you know, the best example I can think of is that the three-star restaurants, Michelin restaurants in Europe, like Gordon Ramsay and Bocuse, you walk in, they make you feel like your long-lost family. But from a position of a server, you know, they're being professional, but they're being genuinely warm. And
well, I think you used the key word there is genuine.
Yeah, and that's where you get to the tricky part of training hospitality. In the book, Waldy is quoted as saying, yes, you can train hospitality, but they have to want to do it. And, you know, our good friend Dale DeGroff is famous for saying, I can teach a bartender to make drinks, but I can't teach him to be nice.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So I think that there has to be some sort of underlying, there has to be a little light under the bushel somewhere of love of people. And then you can, you know, you can fan the flames and make turn someone into a truly hospitable server. But if you have someone who has a dark little heart, you know, a little piece of coal where there should be a heart, you can teach them the steps, but they won't want to do it for the right reasons. They'll want to do it because they can make $1,200 a week.
Yeah, I just think that it's you can't really teach that. You have to have it innately.
But you know, what's interesting is that I think that speaks to the old stereotype of the snooty maitre d'. But our not snooty maitre d' is a guy named John Fisher. He's the author of At Your Service, A Hands-On Guide to the Professional Dining Room, and a professor at CIA in New York. We'll be talking to him more after the news. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Well, Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com. And now you can download our podcasts on iTunes.
Today our guest is Professor John Fisher. He is the author of a new book called At Your Service, A Hands-On Guide to the Professional Dining Room. He's a professor at CIA, where he teaches about service. And
that's the Culinary Institute of America.
And you know, this book is really great. I just read it last night. It just recently came out. And I thought, we do a lot of consulting, you know. And we consult for new restaurateurs or people who are taking over a restaurant and looking to revamp it. I'm going to recommend this to all my clients. If you have a restaurant, you know, you may know a lot about a lot of different areas, but this is a pretty good comprehensive book. I would go to Amazon.com and pick it up.
That your servers can pick up. Something that if you work in a restaurant, is a good idea to hang on to and take a look at and not just for new ideas, but maybe why you're doing some of the things that you're doing.
I think that it's very hard sometimes for people to, when you're explaining the individual things, when you're explaining each tree, if they don't have a view of the forest, even if their job is just to work on an individual tree, it's really hard. When people understand why they're doing something, it mm-hmm. gets much easier for them to do it. What do you think about that, John?
Well, you know, so many people come into our business for, I'm not going to say the wrong reasons, mm-hmm. but they see a quick buck. They see it as something that they can do part-time. And I think for certain people, the bug bites them. I know that's what happened to me.
Right.
I thought I was looking for a real job in 1984.
You found one, John. You're a professor now.
And I'm in the Library of Congress.
Extraordinary.
But I was bartending at the Chart House, and I was looking for so-called real jobs to use my college education. And then I realized that I loved what I was doing. And I think, to a certain degree, that's what happens to the people who really choose this and take it seriously as a profession.
You know, we did the same thing, actually. We both did. After college, we were bartending, you know, trying a series of different jobs, none of which we liked as well as what we were doing, and eventually wound up doing this on our own. But
I think it's because we're all social deviants.
That's part of it. You know, and I don't have to get, back then, I didn't have to get up as early in the morning if I was in a restaurant business. But you, CIA has sort of changed the paradigm a little bit. I mean, it used to be that you went and you worked in a restaurant, and it was sort of you got to where you got through apprenticeship. Mm-hmm. People are now sending their kids to CIA for 2 and 4 years degrees for, you know, $40,000, $60,000, $70,000. What does a back of the house person has a very intensive cooking education.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think a lot of people understand what a front of the house person gets from attending the Culinary Institute of America for a higher education.
Well, I was unusual, I guess I still am. As a student, I was unusual back in 1986 because I came here to learn how to cook so I could be a better dining room person.
Mm-hmm.
And I was the only so-called coffee slapper in the school.
Coffee slapper being a derogatory term for a front-of-house person.
That's derogatory?
Yeah.
anyway, so there I was, and I knew what I was doing here, going all competing for the same great line cook jobs, and nobody was going for dining room jobs. And I walked into a job with Waldy Maloof, one of the greatest chefs and also a culinary graduate,
mm-hmm.
one of the greatest chefs in New York. And I almost instantly gained access to a pretty rarefied circle because I went into an area where there was less competition for jobs, at least for people who chose it as a profession.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's changed. There are more students now. In fact, the last group that I have that's just graduating today. One student wants to go be in the wine department at Mansion on Turtle Creek in Dallas. Another mm-hmm. one has already passed the first level of Master Sommelier test. Students are looking towards the front of the house much more than before. I'm not going to say it's as many as half of the students, but a good quarter to a third of them are saying, well, maybe I want to cook now, but then I'll do it front of the house. And some mm-hmm. of them are saying, I'm going to go straight into the dining room. And it's I think it's great, personally, to get more trained professionals, whether it's cooking
sure.
or not.
So when they come out of CIA, are they ready?
They're ready to learn more.
Okay.
Just like, you know, a great liberal arts education prepares you to learn for the rest of your life. I think the culinary prepares them to become the best mm. in the business.
You're giving a foundation. You're giving a base, just like a college
yeah.
education.
I mean, how much can you do in 22 months?
Right.
It's like coming out of a great law school. Does that
yeah.
make you a great lawyer?
Yeah.
No. But, you know, does it give you the foundation that you can build on? You know, I think one of the things that is a very positive thing that comes out of CIA grads is that being forced to take courses in things that are outside your area of interest. So if you're interested in the front of the house, you have to take some cooking classes. If you're interested in the back of the house, you need to take some front of the house hospitality and management courses.
It's a broader understanding.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And one of the things that we find when we consult, people approach us for consulting jobs, there are consulting jobs that we turn down because someone is an awesome bartender, knows everything about the front of the house, nothing about the kitchen, and has no plan to.
Mm-hmm.
Or they're an amazing chef, but they have no idea how the money works or how to greet people at the door.
Right. Or
and
more than more
then
than,
you're doomed.
Right. More than turn it down, what we're convincing people not to move into that arena until they have a broader background.
Yeah, and I think that when you have someone who is an employee who is naturally curious and you want to feed that curiosity, you say, yeah, come on in. I know you're a great bartender. Do you want to work on the Colts? Do you want to learn how to make salads? And next thing you know, there's that, I think somewhat related to this was that New Yorker writer who went to write a story on Babbo and ended up on the line there.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, people have that natural curiosity and that really want to learn the whole, the whole enchilada, as it were. They're going to be worth more to you down the road.
Yeah.
And be able to, again, I came here to learn how to cook so I could be a better manager. Because how are you going to manage a restaurant when you don't know how the kitchen works?
You know, you blazed some new trails back then because you were a front-of-house guy with a back-of-house training. And I remember when we first met, I thought that was kind of an anomaly.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that we've battled in our 14 years of owning our own place is we came out of some places where there was real, most places had a real animosity between the front of the house and the back of the house.
I think that's still the case in some places.
But the great restaurants are getting rid of that. What mm-hmm. is that animosity from between the cooks and the waiters? Where does that come from, and why is it changing in the best places?
Well, I think it's a combination of ignorance and jealousy. And there's actually a bit in the book about this. In fact, the chapter that I'm most proud of is the chapter on front of the house, back of the house relations, because I've been blessed with mostly great relationships with chefs,
mm-hmm.
and have also had the reality of a couple of bad ones. Just to keep reality in.
Yeah, but that's where your best stories come from, Jim.
I didn't put any of those in. But I'll tell
that's
you
the next book.
But the relationship, the cooks see the waiters counting cash at the end of the night and walking home clean and dry. The waiters look into the dining room, into the kitchen, and they see the cooks eating whatever they want, whenever they want. Of course, neither of those views of what the other person is doing is true.
Right.
Because we know how hard it is to work in a dining room, and any cook who has waited tables at all soon recognizes how hard it is. And the waiters look in and see the kitchen, and I don't know if they realize the insane level of concentration that it takes to be a great line cook.
Mm-hmm.
And so the combination of the jealousy and the ignorance can lead to the negative relationship. It's up to the leaders in a restaurant to build the good relationship.
When you see a chef like Gordon Ramsay on that reality TV show where he just spends his time ripping into people, and what are your thoughts on that style of management and hierarchy and power relations in a restaurant?
Well, I don't know if he's like that all the time because in his defense, when we were in France a year and a half ago on our professional development trip, we had to ride around France and eat and drink for work.
Booby.
It was terrible. but our last meal was at Gordon Ramsay at the eponymous mm-hmm. restaurant, and it was the best meal I've had in my life.
Right.
And
yeah.
as nice as I am usually when I'm discussing restaurants that I've been to, I've never used the word perfect, and it was perfect.
I think though sometimes when you come to a show like when you watch one of those reality shows like that, you have to realize that they're unreal.
Yeah. Right. Well, we're going to be talking more with John Fisher. He's the author of At Your Service, A Hands-On Guide to the Professional Dining Room. He's an instructor and a professor at the Culinary Institute of America, and we'll be talking more with him in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45. Hi, this is Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants and also of the Restaurant Guys radio show. You know, one of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome. It's what I love most about what I do. But it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group. Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional. That can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to RestaurantGuysRadio.com and click on the Mardini Group link, or call them at 718-694-9944. The Mardini Group for graphic design, 718-694-9944.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys.
Hey, you're back at the Restaurant Guys. Mark Pascal and Francis Shadow, stage left in Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. And our guest today is Professor John Fisher of the Culinary Institute of America. He's the author of a new book called At Your Service, and we're talking to him about restaurants and service in America. You know, one of the things about this book that I think is really interesting is it's a very good practical guide for service. And if you have a restaurant and you want to refine some of your training to help your staff serve better and kind of clarify your own ideas on reservations policy, service, hospitality, it's a great book. But you also talk, John, you put things in a broader context. And in fact, you have a lot. You talk a lot about food history and the history of restaurants from Greek to Roman to medieval times. Why don't you talk to us a little bit about that?
Well, you know, obviously our business goes back quite a bit, but it really is important for us to consider where entertaining and service have come from, to have a working knowledge of it, to be able to grasp the both the physical and the emotional side of what we do. I think.
Yeah, but it's also cool. Talk to us about the Greeks and Romans. It was fun. I loved reading that.
Oh, you mean the Greek people with the couches?
Yeah.
Yeah, the Greeks would have dining salons that had these large couches, and they would lounge on them, leaning on their left elbow, reclining, and then the servants would bring the food to them while reclined on these couches. And you knew how rich somebody was by how many couches they had in their dining room.
I just have a horrible image in my head of you, me, and Mark on couches and togas with servants bringing us grapes.
Wiping our hands on the dogs.
That's a terrible image. Another funny thing is that as things moved along and drapery started making it onto tables, that tablecloths were originally used for the napkins.
Mm-hmm.
The tablecloth was there so you could wipe your hands.
Yeah, we frown on that now. That's definitely something that's changed.
Changing when they would give the guests scissors,
a
little napkin, and then they decided to have the napkin separate. So.
You made that part up about the scissors.
Yes,
right?
I did.
All right, well, there was the angle.
I'm a writer now. I'm creative.
Now, what about you? Also, talk about the introduction of the fork. This was a huge thing, right?
Well, yeah, because it was when men and women started dining together as part of that era.
One of my favorite developments.
And it was when, you know, all of a sudden, instead of picking up the joint of mutton a la King Henry VIII, you were actually eating it with a fork in a more civilized way. You weren't handling the food at the table with your hands. And it was Caterina de' Medici, after whom our restaurant school is named, who brought the three-pronged fork from Italy to France. So as much as the French might argue, the Italians were the ones who introduced that level of civility to the table. And interestingly, I don't know if I put it in the book or not, but the reason that dishes with spinach are called Florentine is because she brought spinach from Florence to France.
Interesting. Now, the thing is, when you introduce the fork, you introduce a whole new level, because now all of a sudden, as a diner, you're not filthy.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So you can have nicer napkins, and you can. That was sort of the beginning. The reason the introduction of the fork
right.
is so important
was a jumping off point.
That's the beginning of modern table manners.
Yeah, napery was no longer filthy at the end of the meal,
right?
Because they were just wiping their mouths with it. They weren't just, you know, having to roll in the tablecloth at the end to get all the fat off.
And that was before the invention of the fire hose.
Do whenever I get a chance.
Right, but. Exactly. Now, Then you talk about the French Revolution. What effect did the French Revolution have on the restaurant business?
Oh, it created them?
I read the book, John. Tell everybody else how.
but, you know, all these cooks who have been cooking for rich private households, you know, after the 1789, which my high school history teacher pounded into our heads. After that year, all of a sudden there was a middle class that needed food prepared for themselves. and they had some extra money to spend on it, so it wasn't always being, it wasn't always eating at home. So there were people looking for food. There were cooks without jobs because they were thrown out of the houses of the rich. And so next thing you know, we have a guy opening a place where he starts feeding people with an a la carte menu.
That's,
I think it was a great idea.
I think
whose
that,
time had come.
I think it has legs.
I think it's going somewhere. Well, the book is called At Your Service, and John Fisher is its author, and he's also a professor at the Culinary Institute of America. And I think that stuff is fascinating. And again, I think that when you give people who work with you, and also as a diner, I mean, to see what's going on in a restaurant. I mean, obviously, restaurant reality shows are really popular for a reason. People want to see how it works. I mean, you know, it's in a way, it's a dinner part. I hate restaurant reality shows, but in a way, you know, throwing an evening in a restaurant is like throwing a dinner party for 300 of your closest friends. What's the distinction?
And that's the beauty of it. When I first started working at Hudson River Club, I would walk through there. You have a great chef. You have wonderful cooks. You have a well-trained staff. A view of the New York Harbor. And you're inviting people into your home. I couldn't afford to have a dining room like that, obviously, of my own.
Well, and it would be rude to charge people if you did invite them
to
your home.
But that's part of what's so...
Hey, wait, there's an idea.
But that's part of what's so addictive to this for people like us. You're actually having a dinner party. That's the way Francis and I treat it, is that we're having a dinner party every night of the week, which we would never be able to do in you know, some other walk of life.
Yeah, not at the level that we do it as professionals. It's just the feeling of hosting, and it's something that I've got from my mother and my family. And, you know, it's just we were the major entertainers of Hastings on Hudson, and an invitation to dinner at our house was looked on with, you know, people were excited to come to our house for dinner because they knew that my mom was a good cook before I was cooking, and there would be, we were careful about choosing the music, and you know, everything that we did, I think, has led to the way I feel about it today. And this is, you know, 24 years that I've been.
But that's what we were talking about before, where you can't teach somebody to be hospitable.
Right.
You learn that. I mean, I'm sorry. You're kind of born with that. It's a feeling inside where you want to make people happy when they're coming into dinner, and you want to make them feel good.
The desire to serve is very important, and
it's important. And it's important to community overall. Listen, our guest is John Fisher. He is the author of At Your Service, A Hands-On Guide to the Professional Dining Room. He's a professor at the Culinary Institute of America, and we're going to talk to him more about how you build a great restaurant staff and what makes a great restaurant staff in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC.
You're back with The Restaurant Guys, Mark Pascal and Francis Shaw. Today we're talking with our friend John Fisher, author of the new book, At Your Service, also professor at the CIA, Culinary Institute of America. John, we're talking about building a staff. One of your big interview tips is to tell a bad joke. Now, John, John, I know you. And the reason you put that in there is because you do that.
Of course I do.
Now, how does telling a bad joke in an interview lead to hiring a better person?
Well, you see how they react to the bad joke. If they laugh because they think it's funny, then you know that they have a terrible sense of humor that will match yours. If they laugh out of obligation, you know that they're probably interested in serving. And if they don't laugh at all, then they either didn't get it or they thought it was stupid and they decided not to laugh at it, and you don't want to hire them because they aren't nice.
What if they call you stupid and slap you in the face?
If they call you stupid?
Yeah.
And, well, if they do it while they're making a funny face, it's okay.
Is it part of a bad joke that they're saying in return?
I think one of the most difficult...
If they tell you a worse joke, then it's interesting.
I think one of the most difficult...
Then it's management.
I think that one of the most difficult things for any restaurateur to do is to build a quality staff. I mean, at Stage Left, it's taken 14 years to get the level of staff that we have.
Yeah.
And at Catherine Lombardi, I mean, we've spent a year hiring and grooming
building people.
We have a very few members of a key core staff that hopefully will blossom over time. But I think that your book, John, At Your Service, from the Culinary Institute of America, which you can buy on Amazon.com, or you can link to...
I have some in the trunk of my car, too.
You can link to through our website. I think it's a great read if you're interested, but if you're in the restaurant business in any capacity, you should really, really pick it up. Thanks for taking the time to come down and talk with us today, John.
My pleasure. Thanks. Absolutely my pleasure, gentlemen.
Thanks, John. It's always good to talk to you, man.
Talk to you soon.
Take care, man. That was John Fisher. He's great. We spent many years being Polish.
Also one of the very first guests on the Restaurant Guys.
Yeah, that's true.
Our first week of shows, John was one of our guests.
That's true. He had at that time not yet published his first book, which is pretty interesting. I think the whole CIA route is amazing, that we have a world-class culinary school that people from...
We have two, one on each coast.
Yeah, but the big one is the New York one for students going into school. And if you want to learn more about CIA, you can go to CIAchef.org. We're going to link it to John Fisher's book, to CIA. On our website. You can go to restaurantguysradio.com. Makes a great Christmas present. I hope you guys enjoyed the last hour listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.